What is so good? What do you call a million? Take all our welfare. Why doesn't Mexico give you welfare?
Anti-immigration protesters in Murrieta yesterday, that's in Riverside County, 140 undocumented migrants, many of them women and children, were on buses that were taking them to the Border Patrol's processing center in Murrieta. Around 100 protesters stood in the street, forcing the three buses to turn around. The migrants had been flown into San Diego from Texas because that state has been overwhelmed by the number of people coming from Central America. Jill Replegel covers the California-Mexico border for the radio station KPBS in San Diego, and she was at the protest. Hi.
Hi.
Well, set the scene for us there yesterday. The buses, they traveled, what, 70 or so miles from the San Diego airport, and what greets them?
Well, about, I would say, 100 to 150 people. It's hard to tell how many were protesters. There were a lot of journalists there as well. And there were some people that were out there to support the immigrants. But definitely the majority were not happy about the transfer of these immigrants to this Border Patrol station. A lot of signs saying, you know, legals go home. At one point, there was a guy yelling, "We don't want you here," at the top of his lungs over and over again. So it was a pretty tense situation. And when the buses pulled up, some people got in front of the buses on the road. The police, this is Murrieta police that were out there, made a minor attempt to get them to move and then just sort of backed off and let the situation play out. And they were there for about 15 minutes, and then they finally backed up and left.
And then there were also counter-protesters, right?
Yeah, so there were a few, and it did get tense a few times. A fight almost broke out a few times. There was a photographer who got a punch thrown at him. There was a man, one of the few people who were sort of speaking up loudly in favor of the immigrants. I found out later, a pretty well-known Mexican singer in his Mexico soccer jersey, and he was getting yelled at very loudly in his face, apparently got spit at by one man, and it got nasty.
Wow, so passions are running really high, it seems, there in Murrieta. And so on the buses, though, 140, mostly parents and children?
Yes, mostly parents and children from South Texas, and they were sent to another Border Patrol station closer to the border, and they began processing there.
Right. And so why were they taken all the way from South Texas to Murrieta?
They're just overwhelmed down there with the number of people, especially families. The U.S. doesn't have facilities for holding families. There's one place that's a longer-term shelter detention center for families in Pennsylvania. And so they're really just overwhelmed. And I think the reason they sent them to Murrieta is because this is a Border Patrol station that's not right on the border. They do sort of more drug interdiction work, and they do some immigration enforcement, but it's inland, and so they were, frankly, less busy and had some people that were, you know, that could have helped lessen the load for the agents in South Texas.
Right. Okay. And so tell us why the people in Murrieta seem to be so angry about this. What was driving their protests?
It was a mix. Some of it stems from a basic opposition to Obama's immigration policy. Some of it is just about Obama himself. I mean, there are a lot of people with, you know, sort of anti-Obama signs and anti-Obama T-shirts. There were people talking about welfare and thinking that immigrants are taking, you know, welfare that they don't deserve. I talked to a few women who had friends who were Border Patrol agents, and they were concerned that the agents might be exposed to diseases, to tuberculosis, even to things like lice and scabies, and they thought that this was unfair. So it really, really ran the gamut.
Okay. And so the buses were turned away, and where did they go?
They went to a station closer to the border. I was told by the union, the Border Patrol union rep who was sort of observing yesterday at the protest, that they actually went to a center that was sort of more equipped to handle families. I mean, there were showers and a rec center. I'm not clear on whether they got sent somewhere after that. It's been a little, the Customs and Border Protection and Immigration and Customs Enforcement hasn't been answering a lot of questions, I think because they probably want to prevent something similar from happening. But they were definitely sent to a border in San Diego County near the border.
All right. And so a little bit about Murrieta and its history with this, because I know that this isn't the first time that there has been some consternation about immigrants coming to their city to be processed.
Yeah, just a little bit of long-term history. I mean, it is a very conservative area of California. A lot of the cities and towns around there have passed or attempted to pass what could be considered undocumented immigrant legislation in the past, things like making it illegal to solicit work on the side of the road, stuff like that. And it's also sort of the birthplace of some of the anti-immigrant groups that that still are around, like the Minutemen and those kinds of groups. And then just on this particular situation, I mean, rumors started flying a couple weeks back that they might be using the station to process people. And the mayor had a press conference on Monday, and he basically encouraged citizens, residents of Murrieta, who were opposed to this, to express their distaste. And other officials as well indicated that they were not happy about this decision. They thought it was a public safety issue, and they were concerned that immigrants were going to be let off on the streets of Murrieta. There's no bus station there. And so they were pretty vocal about their opposition to this. They set up a hotline that's on their website. They have, you know, sort of constant information updated on the city website.
And I understand that there's going to be another meeting or protest or what have you tonight in Murrieta.
Yeah, there's a town hall meeting tonight, and I don't know exactly what that'll look like. I mean, I think that, you know, and it's hard to know how much the city is reacting to fears and concerns that its residents have expressed to them, or whether they're actually taking a position on this issue. But I'm sure that there will be lots of questions, and I imagine some unanswered questions, because it's still unclear whether the federal government is going to try again to use that station to process immigrants, or whether they're going to look elsewhere.
Okay, well, that leaves us a perfect opportunity to go to our next guest who might answer some of those questions. And I want to thank you very much, Jill Replegal, reporter at KPBS San Diego, for covering the story for us. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Randon Lane is joining us now. He is a member of the City Council in Murrieta. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so will you be at this town hall tonight, and were you at the protest yesterday?
I was at the protest yesterday, just because when you have something of this significance in your community, you want to be at least out there to kind of see what's going on. And I will be at the town hall meeting this evening.
Okay. And what about this idea that the mayor and maybe some city officials are encouraging the protesters? Are you among them?
Well, first, I don't think that the mayor really encouraged protesters. I think what we have encouraged everybody from the very beginning is, and try to remind everybody, that we are not the immigration policy makers at the federal level. And we have encouraged everybody, and I do the same, whether you're for or against it, to pass on your opinions to your federal legislators. And that's why on our website, we have placed the phone numbers to all the federal legislators in D.C., the White House. We want the message to be sent to them, whether you're for what's going on or you're against it. And, you know, we're happy to hear. We're happy to listen. We want to try and work with, you know, the federal government through this process. But we want our residents to make sure that their voice is being heard, whatever your stance is on it.
And what is your particular stance on this?
Well, my stance has been from the very beginning that we are lacking communication. I think a lot of the frustration that people have seen has come from the fact that we were not kept in the loop. We were finding things out through websites. We were told, at 6 o'clock on a Friday night that this was going to be happening on Monday or Tuesday. So we have not had really some strong communication from the Border Patrol, from Department of Homeland Security, ICE. And we're still, it's still kind of, to use an old adage, pulling teeth to get some information out of those agencies still. It's gotten better. But, we are policymakers in a community of about 106,000 people, and we're the largest city in Southwest Riverside County. And so, when we're being asked to respond, we would like to be a part of the conversation to make sure that we're responding appropriately.
Mm-hmm. So you'd like some more advance notice than just a couple of days is what you're saying?
Absolutely.
All right. And so what is the problem, though? They're being processed in this ICE facility. And then what is the worry that once they're processed, they will then be released into your city and stay?
Originally, that was the concern. We were at the very beginning told that they were going to be processing 140 undocumented immigrants every 3 days through the remainder of the year. And they were going to be released into the community. So obviously, as a policymaker in a small community that has no major transportation hub really in or around our community, to have 140 people released into our community every 3 days is a big concern. Is 140 people a lot of people? No. But when you start doing the math through the end of the year, that's roughly 8,000 people. And that was the lack of information that we were very frustrated about, because that's what we were hearing. We weren't being told. Nobody had an answer for us. So now that there's more information that has come out, we are trying to communicate that this is a Border Patrol station that's going to be helping the inundation from Texas to process these families. And they are 100% family units that are coming in. And then they are going to be taken to major bus terminals to be sent to either family or friends throughout the U.S.
So does that satisfy your concerns?
It does from a city standpoint. Obviously, it does alleviate my concerns about having this many people. The problem is that we have found that the information has changed day to day and hour to hour. And so until it happens, until we see kind of the process, obviously, our concern is going to remain.
Well, this is a federal processing center, so is there really anything that you can do to stop ICE from processing migrants there?
No. We've said from the very beginning that this is a federal decision. These are people that are making decisions at a federal level, and we're not the federal policymakers. We would just appreciate, and we've said it all along, we would appreciate some type of communication so that when we have residents that are upset, we have people that are coming out to protest, we at least have some information to provide to them, and that it's not just happening behind closed doors and we're not left in the dark.
Right. Now, are you worried, though, that some of the protesters, some of the residents there in Murrieta are maybe engaging in a mob mentality and that they don't have all the information that you have?
I think that obviously if I don't have the information, then some of the protesters and the people that are coming out don't have the information. Since this has happened over the last month, I've probably received more phone calls and emails from the residents of Murrieta than I have, since serving on the city council. And it's because there hasn't been that information. We had people that showed up yesterday. The protest was very civil. And we had people that were coming out, letting their voices be heard. As the day drew on and as it got closer to the evening, we had more protesters show up, and there were probably about 400 protesters last night that had come out, and it started to become a little bit more heated. And I think for myself and for the rest of my council, we're a little disappointed because we've encouraged everybody to share their opinion. Everybody's allowed their opinion, whether you disagree with them or agree with them, it doesn't matter. They're allowed their opinion, and we just encourage everybody to do it in a very civil manner.
Okay, I understand another 2 plane loads of undocumented immigrants are due to arrive in San Diego by the end of the week, and so maybe some of them will be making their way to Murrieta. What's the plan?
We have our police chief who has been having some meetings with the Border Patrol and Department of Homeland Security over the last couple of days, and from my understanding, that decision of whether or not they're coming to Murrieta has not been made.
Okay.
Again, we're waiting to find out.
All right. Randon Lane, City Council member in Murrieta, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, and you have a wonderful day.
You too. Well, what do you think? Should Marietta find a way to deal with this influx of immigrants? Do residents, though, do they have a point in their protests? Give us a call, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can join the conversation on Facebook. And coming up, we're going to pick up this story south of the border in Central America and find out what's driving people to come here. That's next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, we've been hearing about the surge of children from Central America making a very dangerous journey north to try to come to the United States. Since October, more than 50,000 unaccompanied children have been detained, and that's almost double last year's number. Tens of thousands more are thought to have slipped through. Mike McDonald is a reporter for Reuters in Guatemala City. Welcome.
Hi, Madeline. Good to be here.
Well, thanks for being here. And talk a little bit about what's happening where you are. Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, very dangerous right now. And that's what's pushing these children to try to come here?
I think it's one of the factors. I mean, the Northern Triangle in Central America, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, they have some of the highest murder rates in the world. So I think especially in the case of El Salvador and Honduras, I think you're seeing a spike in violence, especially in Honduras and cities like San Pedro Sula. Families fleeing the violence, heading into Mexico, looking for political asylum in Mexico, and if they can't get it there, if they have family members in the U.S. and they're looking to reunite with family there. One of the other big push factors, especially here in Guatemala, which is the least violent of those three countries, but still very violent. One of the biggest factors here is a lack of economic opportunity, which also exists in Honduras and El Salvador. But I think when you travel into some of the rural areas here, where there's a high level of subsistence farming in Guatemala and some of the rural areas, there's just no work to be found. And some of these small communities, they're very, very small communities. Some of them without, even without any schools. And if they have schools, it only reaches, what would be the equivalent of fourth or fifth grade or maybe junior high level.
Right, right. Well, that's been the case for a very, very long time. But that doesn't explain the surge in migrants recently, does it?
Especially in Guatemala, a lot of the children that are crossing the border now, the surge in children, most of them that are crossing into the United States have family members there, have fathers, and in a lot of the cases, they're fathers that are already living there, and fathers that have lived there for a few years, or fathers that have lived there for 10 years, and they're sending, they want their children, they want to be reunited with their children, a lot of the children that are crossing to the U.S., I think the vast majority of them are going to reunite with family members that are already in the U.S., and now that there's talk of immigration reform in the U.S., and there's talk of this deferred status for minors in the U.S., I think that's sort of sending a mixed message back here to Central America to some of these very rural communities, especially in Guatemala, that if you go now, you'll be able to qualify for this, and you'll be able to naturalize yourself or legalize your status in the U.S., and you'll be able to document yourself in the U.S.
Right. Let's talk about that. And you recently visited a shelter in Mexico and talked with some Honduran families there. What did they tell you?
Sure. Last week I was in Tapachula, Mexico, which is in southern Mexico, just about 30 minutes over the border from Guatemala. And there I met with several Honduran families that were in a shelter there, mostly mothers with very young children between the ages of 3 up to 10 and 12, around there, nobody really older than 12. Those families, actually, three families that I spoke to there, they were all from San Pedro Sula in Honduras, which is one of the most dangerous cities in the world, and if not the most dangerous city in the world. They were all fleeing violence. I spoke with one mother there who was with three children. She had three children ages from between ages 4 and 10. they had killed, in street gangs in San Pedro Sula had killed last year 7 members of her family, including her husband, who was killed in December, and they fled Honduras early this year, and they reached Tapachula, Mexico, and they've been there since March. The mother said that she didn't, the street gangs in San Pedro Sula were training her 10-year-old son how to use 9mm, how to load a 9mm, and how to shoot and kill people at age 10. And mm-hmm. so she and her 3 children, what they're doing is they're requesting political asylum in Mexico, which is something that I think a lot of Honduran families have done. They cross Guatemala and then go into Mexico and request political asylum. And if they can't get it, then they journey further north up to the border, Monterrey, Mexico, Tijuana, Mexico, and once they're there, they try and cross into the U.S. So that's a major push vector, especially in Honduras.
Right, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what's driving this incredibly high murder rate and crime rate in Honduras. The Mexican drug gangs, I understand, are using Central American countries like Honduras and Guatemala as shipment points for cocaine coming from South America into the United States.
Right, yeah. The drug trafficking is something that Central American governments just haven't been able to control in recent years. I mean, this is, there's been a rise in murder rates sort of throughout the last decade in most of these countries. The cocaine production is mostly in Colombia and Peru. It comes out of Colombia and Peru, and these cartels basically use Central America, which is right along the route into Mexico and up into the U.S., basically as their transit points. So, they ship it in little go-fast boats. They send planes that land on clandestine runways all across Central America, especially in Honduras and Guatemala. They ship it to El Salvador, and then they on boats, and then they pick it up at the ports and ship it through Guatemala and up through Mexico into the cartel's hands in Mexico, and then smuggle it into the U.S. So that's part of the spike in violence. Another part are these street gangs, the Maras de la Trucha, Trece, and Barrio 18, which are two of the main street gangs that operate in Central America. And in some of these poor neighborhoods, they exert a pretty strong control, much more than the local police.
And MS-13, one of the gangs you just mentioned, originated in the United States among Salvadoran immigrants, right?
Right, correct. I mean, the MS-13 and the 18th Street gangs, I mean, MS-13, in the 90s, that was basically youngsters who had gone to the U.S., fleeing civil wars in Central America, a large portion of them ending up in L.A., and in the 90s, the U.S. had adopted a policy to deport them back here, and so a lot of them ended up back here in the 1990s as deportees from the U.S., and once they were here, they started growing. So, I mean, these are gangs that have, these street gangs, they have a very sophisticated network of connection that extends into the U.S., into California, into Texas, and into Chicago, New York, into several of the U.S. major cities.
And are they working with the Mexican drug trafficking cartels?
Those links are sort of they're not clear. I think some are and some aren't. I mean, the Mexican cartels, tend to ship drugs, and I think with the street gangs, for the Mexican cartels, I think a lot of their income comes from drug shipping. And for some of these street gangs, what they've been doing is running these extortion rackets in urban communities, mostly urban communities in Guatemala City, San Salvador, Tegucigalpa, San Pedro Sula. And so their income comes from these extortion rackets. So, I think to a certain extent, sometimes they overlap. I think sometimes the drug cartels recruit some of these youngsters. But I'm not sure, to what extent. I mean, I don't think it's the vast majority of them, but I think in some cases they do work together, and in other cases they sort of run their separate businesses.
And then thinking about the family that you meant that is seeking amnesty in Mexico, and if that doesn't work, might try to do the same thing in the United States. How successful are these families in being granted amnesty, or how often are they just deported back to Honduras to face this violence all over again?
I've spoken to several families, and I think in speaking with some of the heads of these shelters, the people that run these shelters in Mexico, I think it's more likely that some of these families get some sort of political asylum in Mexico than from the United States. I think it's been very hard for some of these families to get political asylum in the U.S. When they're trying to escape violence, and so they either opt to get it in Mexico, where they think it will be more likely for them to obtain some sort of asylum status. Or if they can't do that, then they would just rather cross illegally into the U.S. because they don't think that they would be able to qualify for some sort of U.S. political asylum. They just see it as less likely. So they think the better option is to sneak in across the border.
Mike McDonald, reporter for Reuters in Guatemala City. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, Future Folk. It's a movie, it's a band, it's a way of life for two guys who decided to play bluegrass music dressed up as space aliens. That story is next on Press Play after a news update from Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
I'm Madeline Brand. You're listening to Press Play. The History of Future Folk is a movie about space aliens who come to Earth to destroy it, but end up playing bluegrass instead. They bill it as the only alien folk duo science fiction action comedy ever made. And how could you argue with that? Variety called it Close Encounters of the Charming Kind.
So, for those of you who don't know me, my name is General Trias, and I come from the planet Hondo. I was sent here to Earth to enact a doomsday device that would destroy the human race forever. You guys shouldn't be laughing. I'm talking about destroying the entire human race. And it's not... All right, well, you must like flesh-eating viruses more than most of the life forms I've encountered.
The story of aliens coming to Earth is, of course, made up, but Future Folk, the band, is real.
Hondo, years ago, all alone and walking down a dusty road, I met a multi-headed stranger.
For a decade, Nils Dallaire and Jay Kleitz have been performing in homemade red spacesuits as General Trias and his trusty sidekick, the mighty Kevin from the planet Hondo. And this summer, the two are leaving that planet on what's been called the Part of Earth Tour. They'll be showing the movie and performing live for adoring and maybe bewildered crowds in 9 cities across the United States. They started off the tour in Los Angeles last night, and they're here now with us on Press Play. Welcome to Planet Earth.
Hondo.
What does Hondo mean? Is there a significance?
Well, for starters, it's our home planet.
And it's an expression that we use to supplement basically any positive adjective, also salutations and goodbyes. So it's a little bit like... Aloha.
Shalom.
Meets, yeah,
sure.
Shalom.
Shalom's a good example.
Meets grok. It's become our catchphrase.
We learned about marketing on Earth, and they said catchphrases are very important.
Yes,
so we've
indeed.
Been saying Hondo all over the planet.
Tell us how this Future Folk thing got started.
We had been playing music, and I think One Night Over Beers had, you know, thrown out this idea of roots music from outer space, and then we were off to the races.
So which came first, the outer space part or the roots music part?
The roots music part. I mean, I think just because I'm an acoustic guitar player, Nils plays many instruments, but the banjo particularly well.
I also play the badanjo.
The badanjo, which is what banjos are on Hondo, obviously.
Obviously.
There's an extra string. It's complicated.
So you were the band first, and then the movie came out of that.
Yeah, we were the band for many years.
And did you always play in costume?
Always.
Yes, and the costumes that we wear in the movie are high-rent versions of the costumes that we started out with. They were originally very DIY, essentially buckets with a face hole cut out of it and a red jumpsuit that gradually became more and more elaborate. Each show we would adorn it with new bells and whistles.
Who designed them? Vivienne Westwood, or
well, actually, the friend who introduced us had been substitute teaching kindergartners at the time, and making these space helmets out of buckets was a project he did with the kids.
Yeah.
So you thought, perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. No, he knew the room when he pitched that one to us.
That's right.
Okay, so your first song was what? The very first song you wrote as these bucket headed aliens?
The first, we wrote sort of a grouping of songs at the very beginning. But one of the first songs we ever played is one that we still play. It's called Space Worms. It's sort of become our anthem.
Well, I guess we need to hear it now.
Yeah, I mean,
and
have
no
to.
Pressure, but
all right, quick tune check. One, two, three, four.
Oh, well, I grew up on a planet forming space worms, where space worms can always be found. Here on Earth, as far as I can discern, there just ain't no space worms around. What can I do? I'm simple farming man, light years away from my home. It's mighty hard to farm this planet's land, where space worms refuse to grow. Oh, well, I grew up on my planet farming space worms, where space worms can always be found. But here on Earth, as far as I can discern, there just ain't no space worms around. It's been struggle, but I refuse to stop. Farming worms is what I was born to do. If you can find me a real good space worm crop, honey, I'll be good to you. Oh, well, I grew up on my planet farming space worms, where space worms can always be found. But here on Earth, as far as I can discern, there just ain't no space worms around. There just ain't no space worms around.
Woo! You now have a following. You've been doing this for 10 years, right?
Yes.
When you first went on stage, what was the reaction?
We've played shows before where we've just haven't been able to win people over. And
what happens then?
It's a little uncomfortable, but I think it's actually a good exercise as an artist and also just as a human being to bomb. It's always a little uncomfortable.
But you can kind of use the costumes as armor in a way, right?
Yeah,
like a shield.
Sure.
Like you can say, "Oh, it's not really me."
That's an excellent point. Yeah, we are in character, you know, to a certain extent. And you're right. I think just the physicality of having another layer between you and the audience does make that a little easier.
Mm. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Jake Leitz and Nils Dallaire. They are future folk aliens and bluegrass musicians on tour right now throughout the United States. Okay, so let's talk about the movie. Your planet Hondo is about to get hit by a meteor and be rendered into oblivion.
That's right.
So you decide Jay, Nils.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
As Trius, General Trius.
Correct.
To kill everybody on Earth.
That's right. And
so you can take over the planet.
Exactly. And I'm about to flip the switch.
When?
When I hear music for the first time
in
a Costco, and it stays in my hand. I hear Muzak.
That's always been a part of our act since the beginning, that we didn't have music on Hondo. And, that's a great gift that we discovered upon arriving at Earth.
And then, Kevin, you're sent down to kill Trius because he's not getting the job done.
I'm sent to finish the job.
Yes.
And I intend to do it.
And you, too,
yeah.
Are transported.
Yes, and I am intoxicated
music.
With music.
Yes.
And it's glory.
And there's a great scene where you, Nils, play the history of music on your banjo.
You know, part of John Anderson Mitchell's wonderful screenplay had this scene where, essentially, without saying a word, I convert the character of Kevin from an enemy into basically an ally through playing on the banjo a medley of royalty-free music that spans across the ages.
Which Nils very aptly is composed, the right word, I don't know.
Arranged.
Arranged, yeah. That's better. Arranged.
It ends up in, what is it, O Fortuna? Yeah. Which, to me, always was a very fun and obviously, you know, very cinematic song that's ubiquitous in movies. So I thought that would be kind of a fun thing to end on.
So then you're converted.
Yes, I'm immediately astonished by the power of music, and I... the scene sort of gets to its climax, and I let out this giant operatic note of music for the very first time.
Musical ecstasy.
Yes. That's right. And then I karate chop him and run away.
Yeah, based on real life.
I do that to him all the time.
Yeah. I like it.
You like it?
Yeah.
All right, speaking of real life, have you guys ever performed as Future Folk on a bill with people who aren't aliens, and how do they react to you?
We've played in all kinds of scenarios. We've played at stand-up comedy shows where we're the only musical act. We've played at musical shows where we're the only, I don't want to say novelty act, but we're the only novelty act. And, you know, I think that coming out with the costumes is a bit of an advantage and a disadvantage. Obviously, you command people's attention when you walk out wearing something outrageous. But at the same time, you have to work a little harder to win people over musically.
Mm. I think one of the things, the fairly universal reactions, whether it's the audience or another band or another comedian or whoever that's there, is that we walk out in these ridiculous spacesuits, and I think initially people assume that it's going to be a very goofy act, and on some levels it is, but our idea has always been that you have to combine the sort of highbrow and the lowbrow at the same time. Like, we aim to have solid, you know, bluegrass music, but kind of goofy space lyrics at the same time. We kind of like putting those two things that don't go together.
But do you think that you're kind of trapped in these personas, or do you think that you can shed them eventually? And
if I'm trapped, I'm happy to be
trapped. Okay.
Yeah. For me, I get actually asked that a lot. Like, doesn't it get old singing about outer space? To me, there's something very exciting about the creative limitations of that construct, and try and push that beyond something that's just a gimmick act. And with novelty songs, into something that has a real emotional relevance. The one thing that gets a little old is those helmets are not very acoustically friendly. And again, this was not thought out. Perhaps if someone had told us that we were going to have a 10-year and then some run with this band, we would have designed costumes that were a little more ergonomic.
And not as hot. They're very warm. It's very, very warm inside the helmets and the suits.
Well, thank you both for coming in.
Our pleasure.
And dropping by on our humble planet.
So happy to be here.
Don't kill us.
I promise we won't.
Nils Dallaire on banjo, Jay Kleitz on guitar, and they are the alien bluegrass duo Future Folk. They're on tour with their movie The History of Future Folk this summer, and you can find out more details on our blog at kcrw.com. And you guys want to play us out with one last song?
Sure. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3.
House-sized house flies, eyes 5 feet wide, 50-foot wingspan. Fleas and bees as tall as trees, ants bigger than a van. On planet Hondo, the insects grow quite slow, till they've grown quite large. Their pincers are fierce, spikers that pierce, their teeth are sharp and long. Yeah, but they never sting, and sometimes they sing, but mostly they're just doing their thing. Yeah, and they're 12 feet tall, with sharp poison claws. But the thought of just makes their skin crawl.
Hondo.
Hondo.
And Hondo to you, Barbara Bogave.
Hondo, I love that. So fun. They're not on To the Point today.
They're not.
No.
They are on point, but they're not on To the Point.
Right. But we're talking about how Speaker John Boehner's gambit to sue the president over presidential overreach. And we're questioning whether both sides of the partisan divide have some concerns, should be concerned, about how far the president goes with his executive power.
Okay, he's issuing executive orders left and right.
Yes.
Okay.
That's the general
direction. We're going to find out more about that at 1 o'clock on To the Point with Barbara Bogave. Thank you for that. And before that, coming up on this program, are you afraid of eavesdropping? Well, a super private smartphone is on the market now. We're going to find out also about an app that weans you off your smartphone addiction. We have a lot of tech news up ahead, all next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Most of us walk around with our entire lives in our pockets, our banking information, our intimate photos, private messages between friends and family. It is the age of the smartphone, and really there's no turning back. But if a smartphone falls into the wrong hands, lives, well, they could be ruined, upended at least. And that's why a Swiss company is introducing the new Black Phone, the first smartphone that goes out of its way to protect all of your data all of the time. Our tech expert, Ariel Bogle, is here to tell us more about it. She's a researcher for Future Tense. That's a collaboration between Slate, New America Foundation, and Arizona State University. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Well, tell us about this Black Phone. What does it do? How does it protect your privacy?
Like you said, it's the first consumer smartphone built just entirely to protect your privacy. And it comes with a whole bunch of features aimed at just that. So it really works like a typical smartphone. It's on an Android platform, but it comes with features like the silent circle, which encrypts all your text messages, your phone calls, your video phone calls. And also a feature called Disconnect, which allows you to browse anonymously online, so people can't really track all the things you're searching for. It also has pretty interesting features like a sort of self-timer, self-destruct messaging system, so you can make sure all your text messages are deleted at a later point.
And I guess the question being, is it really secure? Because as we've seen with things that promise to be secure, they ultimately do get hacked or at least spied upon by powers greater than us.
Right. It's not 100% proven yet, but it's definitely a step in the right direction. The people at the blog Ars Technica got a sort of pre-peek at the smartphone, and they put it through a whole host of tests and said it was one of the best they'd seen. But certainly, we'll see what happens. It was shipped on Monday, so people will be getting their hands on it very shortly. So fingers crossed, it would be a really great step to have that option if you really wanted to protect yourself from companies or people who might want to have a look at what you're doing on your smartphone.
And it's not cheap. It's $629. So you really want to know that you want privacy before you plunk down the cash.
Right. And it's interesting as well. You said that it was a Swiss company, but its main office in America is not in Silicon Valley or New York. It's actually in Washington, D.C. So that kind of suggests maybe what the company is aiming at, more of a government, military audience.
I see. So people who might not be interested in all the iPhone apps, the Apple apps that you can't get on this.
So that's another thing. One drawback for just the regular smartphone user, although it's an Android platform that normally works with Google, you don't really have the same access to the whole Google App Store. You can get some apps in a sort of sideways fashion with some workarounds, but it's really about sort of communicating and protecting your communicating data. It's not really about Snapchat and Instagram.
Okay, well, speaking of smartphones and apps, there's a new app that tries to break us of our bad habits. It's called Moment. And tell us about
right.
that.
Well, Moment is another app that's making me feel really bad about how much I use my smartphone. It's created by this guy called Kevin Halesh, And it simply tracks the amount of times you use your smartphone throughout the day. And it also lets you set daily limits for how much time on your phone that you want to spend, say an hour, 75 minutes, and it gives you warnings when you're reaching that target.
So you need an app to wean you off your cell phone that has lots of apps that you're addicted to?
Right. There is some irony there, but I think it really taps into this growing anxiety we have about the impact technology and smartphones in particular are having on our lives. And it really sort of is part of this whole host of apps and browser additions like Freedom, which just shuts down your internet for a certain amount of time if you need to get work done, or an app called Self Control, which blocks access to social networks for a set amount of time. So hopefully we can all be better in technology users, but
we'll need all these apps. Or you could just press the off button on your computer.
That is always, always an option.
Are you really concerned about your own use of your cell phone? Or are you addicted?
Well, funnily enough, I'm not so addicted to Facebook or Twitter, although I do get a lot of great information off Twitter. But I am an Instagram addict, I have to admit.
What's your Instagram handle?
It's just Ariel Thea, T-H-E-A.
All right, so now we can check your Instagram feed. Not that I'm addicted or anything. But it does raise an interesting idea that at the same time that we have these kind of apps and this desire to disconnect, there's also, on the other hand, things like Google Glass and smartwatches, things that are trying to get us seamlessly connected 24/7.
Right, and it's interesting that these apps are coming out at the same time as you said, Google is getting further and further into our lives. Only a week or two ago, they purchased Nest, which is a company that has connected devices, say fire alarms, garage doors, and connects them to the internet so you can control them remotely. So we give a little, we take a little, but it's an ongoing battle.
Okay, moving on. The FDA has just approved a brand new technology that could have a big impact on people who have lost the use of their legs, and it's a robotic exoskeleton. Tell us about ReWalk.
This is a really interesting and I think important development for paraplegics, people that have lost the use of their legs. It was invented by a company called Argo Medical Technologies, and in fact, the founder and the inventor of ReWalk, Dr. Amit Gopher, is a quadriplegic himself. So he had an interest in coming up with technologies that help disabled people sort of get on with their lives, and this device is one step in that direction. It consists of a brace which goes over the legs and torso and has a computer based control system in a backpack that the person wears, and then it has these motors which control the joints and sort of simulate walking, sitting, standing up, turning, and then the person wearing the brace and backpack can control the exoskeleton's movements with a device on their wrist.
Wow. And so do people see ultimately this as a way to get rid of the wheelchair?
Well, I think a lot of people would like it to be, but the thing is with this industry, it's very, although the technology is exciting and moving at a fast pace, we in the bureaucracy don't move quite as fast. For instance, this exoskeleton costs about $70,000, so it's not accessible to just anyone, and it may take quite a while before Medicaid or your insurance would pay for you to have one.
Okay, moving on to the world's most famous computer. His name is Watson, and he's known for winning on Jeopardy. Now he has decided to take on Gordon Ramsay, I guess.
That's right. Chef Watson, they're calling him. This is a collaboration between IBM and the food magazine Bon Appetit, which you might be familiar with.
Yeah.
Chef Watson combines Bon Appetit's huge recipe database, more than 9,000 recipes, with thousands of complementary flavor compounds that the people at IBM have logged. For example, roast beef, beer, peanuts, and popcorn all share complementary flavor compounds, so they might all be good in a dish together, if you can imagine.
Actually, I can imagine. I can imagine that. I don't want to eat it, but I can imagine. And so how does it work? You, for example, come home one day, you look in your cupboard and you see, let's say, some quinoa and some Chef Boyardee. And in the fridge, you have some butter and let's say some milk. And it'll say, voila, you can have this amazing 3-star Michelin meal.
Right. That's one way of using it. And you can also say, I want a dish in a classic American style, in a Mexican style, in a Vietnamese style. And it will go through all those flavor compounds and then also put together all the different varieties and ways of cooking that are in the Bon Appetit recipes. So then you can, it'll give you some options and you can sort of be inspired or follow it to some degree.
Ariel Bogle is a researcher for Future Tense. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me again.
I don't know about you, Julie Myers, but I am ready for Watson to cook me up some lunch.
Yeah, if Watson can just get on, I don't know.
First,
maybe
he needs some hands, though.
He needs some hands, but I'll supply the cheese. We'll have gourmet grilled cheeses. They'll be delicious. Okay, so on to feedback.
Lots of people wrote in, I guess.
You are correct. lots of controversy over this anti-immigrant protest in Murrieta. The Facebook page pretty much exploded.
Okay.
After we did our segment, and boy, are the trolls out, but we are not going to lend them any credence today. Let's talk about some constructive comments. Luis Carrillo left a comment on our Facebook page. He says, the whole situation is incredibly sad. No matter how the immigrants got here, the fact is that they are here. And if we want them to go back to their home countries, then they need to be processed. These protests just don't make sense. Well, Jim Garrett responded directly to Luis's comment. He says that if Luis feels so strongly about it, then maybe he should open his own home to the immigrants, see how he likes housing, feeding, and clothing them. So even on Facebook, it's getting pretty contentious. Jose called in. He wanted to do a bit of dot connecting for us when it comes to the immigrants.
Some of them are coming from violent areas, some of that violence stemming from drugs. And the drug lords down there wouldn't be making a profit if there wasn't a market up here in the United States, Americans using drugs. There's a CIA term called blowback, and this is part of it.
So he's touching on a little bit of what we heard in the show about from that reporter in Guatemala.
Mm-hmm.
And so he says, if you don't want the immigrants, stop doing the drugs. I don't know if it's the same people protesting, but David called in too, and he says the protesters in Murrieta are totally out of line.
Those people in Murrieta screamed at children. I wonder whether they went home and screamed at their gardener or their cleaning lady or the pool man, who's the children are fleeing for their lives.
So obviously David was a little bit emotional about this, but as we can see, emotions are running high. Back on Facebook, Anna Julia Ferrer Jenkins says that the protesters have no idea what these children and families have had to go through to get to this point in Murrieta. Waving American flags and spewing hate seem particularly heartless given what these families have been through, and they are being processed to go home, or trying to.
Okay, lots of opinions and, as you say, a lot of emotions on this topic, and you are welcome to weigh in on this, so please do at our Facebook page, KCRW's Press Play. We're also on Twitter, at KCRW Press Play, and you can leave a voicemail at any time, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. Julie Myers, thank you very much. Barbara Bogave is up next on To The Point. That's at 1 o'clock. She's filling in for Warren Olney. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you tomorrow.